Look forward to a forecast of a different kind, this time in English, as you can hear. And my guest is Jason Wright, a longtime friend of mine, now for about 30 years. He's one of the most gifted musicians I know, one of the most fascinating human beings I know, with an incredible life history of ups and downs, and always guided by his passion for music and creation and touching souls. And during the forecast, we touch all sorts of subjects, from his alcohol addiction to his music addiction to his love for humans to his criticism of politics and the way that things work in the world right now. And it's a journey through life and through transformation in life. And Jason is a role model in that. And there's many conclusions to be drawn for business as well. Because we always say organizational transformation is personal transformation. And Jason's life is absolute role model-like regarding personal transformation. Enjoy the forecast. This is forecast number 11. And as you can hear, it's not going down in German this time. It's going down in English. And the reason being is that I have one of my oldest friends sitting here today. Usually people, when they've known me for a long time, shy away from me sooner or later. This individual doesn't, which I'm very thankful for. So basically, this is going to be a conversation, and you are going to be able to feel the love that I have for this individual. And the love's developed over almost three decades. In the end of the 90s, I went to the Nachtschicht in Heidelberg to listen to this fantastic live band called The Right Thing. And we both don't really know how we've gotten to know each other back in the days, but we did. And now for almost 30 years, there's a friendship that's connecting us. And we're going to get into that and why we are friends and what we believe is right and what we share as values during the conversation. But I'm welcoming Jason Wright to the forecast.
Hello.
Great stuff. Great stuff that you're here. Jason has just had his 66th birthday and looks younger than ever, as he does.
Thank you.
As he does. And we're going to start with the check-in question, as we always do. And the team is prepared in English. Fantastic. Wonderful. What are you irresponsible about?
What am I irresponsible about?
What are you irresponsible about?
Well, just about everything except the work. I would say, yes, it's no, irresponsible about. Mm. Goodness me. Well, just about everything that I'm supposed to be responsible about. Part of being in this country is that everybody takes everything very seriously, like, you know, taxes and their health and tidying up the house and this sort of thing. And I just can't be bothered with any of that stuff. Mm. So I let it all go. And, yeah, there are some consequences for that. But so far, I don't have any intention of mending my ways.
Do you perceive Germany as a very responsible country then?
Do I think Germany is responsible?
Yeah.
Well, compared to most of the other countries in the world, I'm quite impressed with what I managed to understand from the politicians and the things that happen. I mean, I'm quite happy that we have the guys that we do have, and instead of certain other countries that I'm glad I don't live in.
Mm.
Yeah.
There's probably this sense of irresponsibility that attracts me to you, because you've definitely been somebody that's lived his life according to what he felt was right, as in what he felt attracted himself regarding lust, regarding arts, regarding just stuff that you feel that you want to do. And I think you've felt you've lived a very feeling-based life. I mean, you've devoted your entire life to music. You've devoted your entire life to basically orchestrating individuals around music. And that's just something that shapes you. And I think that's something that's kept you on your toes, I guess.
Yeah, oh, for sure, for sure. I don't think it's irresponsible to follow your star. And I think that there have been a number of times, for me anyway, when I've seen what probably the path of least resistance or most responsible and most, what's the word? Careful, least amount of risk involved was. But I've wanted to go in another direction. And everybody's saying, oh, you know, I wouldn't do that if I was you. You look how you, where will you be when you're 66? I was secretly hoping not to be here still at 66, but I'm not quite sure how that happened. I didn't drop dead yet, you know. And mm-hmm. I look back on stuff. You know, I don't remember doing things correctly in my teens and in my 20s and 30s and 40s. I don't remember the days that I went shopping and bought all the right things on a list. You know, I remember the days when something really marvelous happened. Mm. And it was usually something I wasn't supposed to be doing with somebody I wasn't supposed to be with in a place I'd not told anybody about. But that's what I remember as the magic moments. Mm. You know? And so I would say that if you... I don't know if it's possible in Germany to do what I've done. Because to do the things I've done. But in England, there is no right way of doing anything. Because mm. there's, you know, that's why we produce people like, you know, Oasis and Monty Python. Mm. Because there isn't a correct way to be.
Yeah.
The kids in my school who got everything right, who got the grade A's, went to the good universities, didn't do the things I did as a teenager, they had the problems later on. They were the ones who had the nervous breakdowns and this sort of thing. And I don't think there's anything terrible about trying to be a 16, 17, 18-year-old. And here it's like you've got to study. You need to get your, what is it, your abitur. No, you don't. When you're 16, 17, 18, you need to get drunk, travel, and get some pussy. That's what you need to do, you know, when you're that age.
Couldn't have put it any better. And that really never stops. You should be keeping, you should get that throughout your life, really, if you're living a decent life. Mm. And but you came to Germany in your what then, 40s, 30s?
Well, I've been here quite often before, but never for very long. Mm. I mean, my typical trip to Germany in the previous life was we'd arrive at an airport, go to a TV show, play a stupid pop song, buy some drugs, stay in a hotel, get back on the plane and go back to England and collect some money. That was my relationship with most countries in the world. I didn't know much about Germany. I didn't want to live in Germany. I wanted to live in France, so I did.
Yep.
Lived in France for a long time. Wasn't much different. But Germany was completely by accident. And it's funny that, really, because I never really considered living here until I found myself, you know, having to. I want a durable reason to live here, you know?
Well, why did you have to?
Well, when I met you at the Nachtschicht, I didn't live here.
Yeah.
In those heady days of the 90s, I didn't live here. I actually lived in London then and had all my business in London. And I was coming here to do the shows, and it just got more and more complicated because things were happening like hell in this area. Yep. And I was driving back to London to keep up the obligations. So I would finish the show at the Nachtschicht, get in the car, drive to London, and then play it in a studio on Tuesday afternoon. And everybody said, oh, you look tired. And I thought, if only you knew what's going on.
Yeah.
And then, as you know, I started bringing people from England over here
to
play over here, which was also interesting. And that might have been when we met, because I brought Angie Brown over and you knew her.
Yes.
So that was quite early on in the business.
Yep.
That would have put you in the dressing room at the Nachtschicht, which was a hellhole, wasn't it?
I remember it well. And that was in 97, 98. I was just doing my exam at law school.
Yeah, right.
And you were like a pilgrim. It was like a pilgrimage for me. Monday night at the Nachtschicht was something that I'd always look forward to, that I'd always indulge in. And that would basically change my view on life as well, because I was very conscientious in studying and just, you know, getting my degree and everything. But being in touch with you and with the entire music industry and all its chaos and havoc and just free life just basically started opening me up to a different world, or just to different, just a different vibe, different acumen. And that's why I attribute a lot to who I am today, also to you and everything that happened back in these days. It's a time that I really cherish looking back. It's been a fantastic time.
Well, it was insane, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that particular, I'm sorry that we couldn't have made that insanity broadcast a bit further. But that's a whole other story.
No, it's not. Because actually, I want to dig into that. Because, I mean, what you did back then, as far as musical performance artistry was concerned, was to me and to many others just the best you could imagine. It was some of the best live music I've heard anywhere in the world at any point in time. And for some reason, the commercialization that you were probably hoping for and everybody was hoping for just didn't take place. It kept sort of within this ecosystem, Rhein-Neckar, and didn't really evolve beyond that. Do you have any any reason? Can you explain why that happened or didn't happen?
I can explain exactly why that happened, but it isn't very nice.
And, well, go on. This is not a nice podcast. This is a subjectivity podcast. You can speak your mind.
Yeah, but, you know, people are going to watch it and they're going to say, do you know what he said about you?
Yeah.
You don't have to pinpoint individuals. It's always like a systematic phenomenon.
Impossible not to, I'm afraid.
Try to.
You know. But we didn't keep any of the money from that show in Heidelberg, which wasn't the only thing we were doing, but it was a pretty big part of it because it was a huge thing to arrange. I thought if we can do that here, I mean, I didn't plan on doing any of this. I had to get the address in Germany for no other reason than to fit in with the business laws here. Mm-hmm. If you're making that much money, you have to have a GBR.
Oh, yeah.
A GBR. We started a GBR.
Yep.
Because I had to have some place to put the money.
Yep.
And I had to have an address in Germany, which is why I got the address with Ian in Heidelberg.
Yep.
That was the only reason.
Bergheimer Straße.
And the thing started to take off. And I just met all these people. All these people came out of the woodwork. And I had no idea who I was mixing with. I remember one night we had a guy called Schuler, or was it Brazinger, or was it both of them? Schuler and Brazinger. Do you know who they are?
No.
Oh, you do? They owned the Dorian Gray Club in Frankfurt.
Oh, yeah.
And about 11 other places.
Legendary.
Yeah. They said, hey, you know, we could really imagine you putting this stuff on in our places. And I said, so can I.
Yeah.
Until I went to look at them. And the trouble is that their discotheques made of steel with horrible disco balls on the roof.
Yeah.
No way you could get an atmosphere like that in any of them. And I said, I probably could do this in one or two of these clubs, but we'd need to transform them totally to do that. And they said, well, don't think we can do that. They're made to do what they do, which is their techno house clubs.
Mm.
But I didn't make enough of that relationship because I didn't know how influential these people probably could have been.
Yeah.
But they were just two of the people we met.
Yeah.
And we had enormous support. I wanted to take this thing to a number of other cities, not just in Germany, but starting off in Germany, because what it is, apart from being a great night's music, which is why I was doing it, it was also a great dating agency for people who don't like discotheques.
And that's true.
The amount of weddings that I've played since then for people who met there.
Mine too. Oh, I didn't meet my ex-wife.
Well, she didn't meet there. But yeah. It was, you know what it was like. You could talk to anybody there, 1,500 people, allegedly, in the club.
Yeah.
Got a file limit of 1,000. And anybody there, you could say, do you come here often? Mm. And they'd say, yeah, I love it here. Who's your favorite singer? You know, sitting at the front, we had Steffi Graf and Prenson and all these people. And just, and they're in the dressing room. Well, he knows in the dressing room. Hadaway.
Yeah.
Howie D from the Backstreet Boys, you know, just hanging out, drinking and smoking dope. And then Xavier Naidoo, who wasn't famous yet, became famous.
I remember the night Xavier Naidoo stood on stage. Nobody knew him, and everybody was blown away by what he was doing. Yeah,
he sang "Like Jesus to a Child."
Yeah,
in G and "Meine Stadt," which we wrote. Well, we wrote in my house in the afternoon.
Really?
It's only got three chords, you know. And I had the privilege of singing that with the. What moment are we? How many minutes in the podcast are we?
Oh, it's about 15.
Right, I've got to go. So I mentioned Rolf's name. He wants to know at what point I mentioned his name. So I've got to mention.
You can look it up. Yeah, I'll tell him.
We sang Meine Stadt about a month or 2 months ago at Christmas time in Mannheim at the Waldhof Stadium for this Christmas sing-song with him and Torsten Rieler, who I also met then, who was just a little guy, and now he's was he Bürgermeister or something like that.
Mannheim, I think it is.
And he sang it as well. And these people, they all knew the words. And I thought, if only we knew, you know, these three chords. And he sang "The Lion Sleeps Tonight" as well. And he was brilliant.
He was brilliant. And I mean, he pursued the career that he did. And now he's taken a couple of turns of, you can call them unfortunate in the public eye, but he will remain just a fantastic singer throughout time.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Well, you weren't willing to transform these venues, as in disco balls and, you know, steel discotheques, because you felt it wasn't right. And, you know, the transform idea really sort of shapes our environment here. And which points in life do you recall where you feel your life has transformed, or where you've become somebody else because
something has happened? Is there specific just points in time in your life that you recall?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's been a few. There's the obvious one. The people who know me would know, which is when I managed to get off the drink and the drugs. That was definitely, I was 28, when I had the first day without having to do that.
Okay.
That's definitely life-transforming. I recommend it to anybody who's in that prison. Try and get a day without it. And I didn't do that alone. And I mean, really, that was like waking up in a new life.
Why did you? You felt you were going to die if you didn't take that.
I knew I was going to die if I didn't take that step. It's just a question of how much longer I'd have to put up with being alive doing it. You know, it's a terrible prison to be in. Only people who are in it know. I could say people who are stuck with smoking and can't stop smoking have some idea what it's like to be at war with yourself.
Yeah.
Like, I won't smoke today, but I won't throw the pack of cigarettes away either. Mm. Now, why wouldn't you throw the pack of cigarettes away if you were intending to stop? Because you can't imagine not doing it, you know. Same with, I mean, shopping, and there's all sorts of addictions you can get into. But the drink and drugs one, I'm sorry to say, that has you waking up in strange places and strange beds and wondering what on earth you did that for again. And it's a bit like you're in the car, but somebody else has got the driving wheel. And you've got no them, they're nuts. And you're like, where are we going this time? Never you mind. I'm in charge now. And but the mechanics of it, the way it begins, starts with the first drink. But of course, it doesn't start with the first drink. It starts with whatever it was in the first place that you had the first drink about back along. You
society
know?
Basically leads you there too. I mean, it's society confronts you with alcohol immediately. I mean, the moment that you become like a teenager, it becomes almost a normality to consume it. And then you get dragged into it with parties and you're the odd one out if you don't consume and all of that. So it basically, everything's sketched out.
Yeah, but it's not the drink's fault and it's not society's fault. It's because we're all these fragile little individuals and we get to an age when we have to deal with that. Mm. And it's, I would say, a very appropriate solution when it works. I don't think drinking was my problem. It was a solution for a while.
Mm.
Very good one.
For what problem?
Shyness, lack of self-esteem, couldn't belong to anything, always felt left out in the playground, whether I was in the middle of it, on the edge of it, I felt like I didn't belong. And then like Obelix and the magic potion, you take a bit of this and suddenly you can dance, you can chat, you feel connected, you can all do something together, let's break some windows, you know? And that was fine. And it enabled me to... It was a catalyst that enabled me to whatever the word is, what you do with
co-create.
Other people, interact.
Yep.
Unfortunately, I liked it that much that, I mean, you get a headache, you take an aspirin. The headache goes away. Great. You get a headache, take an aspirin. Next time, you have two.
Mm-hmm.
Next time, you've got to have a few more. And then you find yourself waking up in the morning and just shoveling mouthfuls of aspirin down because it's the one thing you found that worked, you know. Plus, of course, the immediate feeling of well-being that you get from the first glass of wine. I mean...
Yeah,
the first glass of wine is great.
We all know that. Yep.
Yeah. The trouble is I couldn't stop doing it. It became an obsession.
But then at 20, I mean, 28 is not even, I mean, not even half your life. I mean, it's really sort of a reasonably, when did you start drinking? 17?
No, 13, 14.
Okay.
Public school.
Okay.
You know, sneaking stuff to the dormitory.
And what are the years like from your 28 to the 35th year look like, or like the time after?
Well, completely different, because one of the definitions of recovery from addiction is you introduce yourself to yourself to see if you get on.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of work. I'd recommend anybody, whether you're addicted or not, to do the 12 steps in the 12 step program, because it's such a, you turn your life inside out, you know, it's write an inventory of everything so far. What did I do when I was a kid? What did I do as a teenager? How did I feel about it then?
Mm.
And, you know, it's quite sad. You go back and there's this little guy who was like 9 years old and lost.
Mm.
And you can try and get a photograph of me. It's like, I remember how I felt. And you wish you could pick him up and say, listen, it's going to be all right. You're going to be this guy later on. You're not going to worry about this stuff. But at the time, I was just, you know, lost, and like most people are. I fly a bit. Well, you know, we've flown together.
Yes.
And I fly over the Odenwald and I see these little villages. And there's a little village and it's 10 miles from the little town. And the little town is 40 miles from the big town, like Aschaffenburg. The little town would be Airbuck, mm-hmm. and the little village would be Hinterdumpfink in the middle of nowhere. And some poor guy is a teenager in that little village, and he's not even old enough to ride a mofa.
Yep.
You know, and he's amassing mass of testosterone. Of course, these days you've got the internet, so you're not that disconnected.
Mm. That can lead to even more disconnection.
Well, exactly. You know, I can see that people now reach for whatever you can find.
Yeah.
And, you know, the internet get into that, and all you in the chat rooms, and you're joining the AFD or whatever because you feel like, well, join something, be important. And then, of course, anything, and that's what I mean about it's not the alcohol's fault. Because you go to the little village and you try not to look at the big guys because they'll beat you up, and there's some bloody awful thing going on, and the girls are all in there. I have no idea how you get one of those, you know? Mm. And I'm this 16-year-old with no money and I haven't got a car. And then somebody says, well, listen, have a Jägermeister. And
yep.
You think, whoa, well, actually, maybe I can go in there, maybe I can dance. And that's how it begins.
Mm.
You know, it's not the alcohol's fault. It's not like you shouldn't touch it. It'll kill you.
Maybe humans are just designed to make this type of experience before they turn their lives around. Maybe everything just happens via urgency, like in your case, near death. Or, you know, I'm not saying I've lost faith in the human mind to be able to actually consciously lead itself, you know, without tipping into all these pitfalls that are there along the way. But it certainly helps to have had experience like that to truly find oneself.
Yeah.
But then, you know, beyond 28 and then, you know, the years ongoing, first of all, your entire social life must have changed. Maybe your circle of friends has changed. Maybe your entire way of leading yourself has changed. And what were like further transformation points in the years following that? What happened in your life?
Gosh.
Since that transformed you?
These are great questions. Luckily, I have asked these questions over the years. Well, for a start, the music, and this is going to blow everybody away, I guess, well, not blow everybody away, is that, you see, if you can play music in my day, which is, you know, in the days when you used to have steam trains and barrage balloons and stuff, but we used to play, and if you could play, you had to go to the big city and try and join a band, and then the band would try and get a record deal, because nobody could afford to record music. I mean, studios were like the Starship Enterprise, and you couldn't get in. You couldn't pay your own studio time. Although they did start in my day with things like 8-track, 4-track recorders. But even that was a luxury. You know, I mean, a 4-track reel-to-reel when I was 18 or 19 years old was the equivalent of about 10 grand today. Mm. You know, I mean, it's like these cameras. They're very expensive.
Yep.
They're not half as expensive as they used to be. You know, a Hasselblad still camera used to be more than a car, you know. And so I did that. And, you know, I did wonder, having been a bit of a virtuoso kid, why the definition of success with playing music is standing on TV with a keyboard strapped around your neck, looking at the camera with the red light on, playing a pop song, Girl, I Love Your Bum, Girl, I Love Your Bum. There you go. Okay, now to the next studio, Girl, I Love Your Bum. And you think, what happened to the playing?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't I get into this because I wanted to play? That's the first thing that goes out the window is the playing.
Yeah.
So after getting sober and putting up with Girl, I Love Your Bum for a bit longer, I just woke up one day and I thought, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to play. And it was really like a hangar door opening.
Yeah, of like, that's a mega decision to make.
Yeah. And it happened. Oh, this is even more interesting. Boring. I don't know. I went on a tour to France to look at some things and to meet some people I hadn't seen for years. And I wound up in a place called Collioure in the south of France. It's where Matisse used to live. It's mm-hmm. on the coast. It's really pretty. And I was alone. And I'd split with the girlfriend and everything had gone wrong in London. And I thought, what am I doing any of this for? Stone cold sober. Right? And there was these two guys on the beach. One had a keyboard and one had a guitar. And there was about 100 people listening to this beautiful music they made. It was sort of three simple major chords and a bit of Spanish guitar. And it was just lovely. It was like Pat Metheny, but mm-hmm. nothing like as elaborate as Pat Metheny.
Yeah.
And I went down there and listened. It was just so beautiful. And I'd had this catalogue of disasters in life and in business and everything. And I said to them, can I just play a bit? Because I hadn't for a few days. And I played this blues, you know, I mean in G or something. I said, it's just three chords. It's a 12-bar blues. And I started playing the blues. And the people just went mad sitting there. And I was so full of emotion and frustration, and it was, must have all come out of the speaker somewhere.
Wow.
And the people were in fucking tears. It was great, and so was I. And they said, wow, I don't know who you are, but they took me to the jazz club in Collioure, and I played jazz all night with these strangers in Collioure till about 3 a.m. Mm. Went back to my hotel, and I thought, what the fuck have I been doing for the last years, standing on TV with a plastic keyboard around my neck saying, girl, I love your bum.
Yeah.
I should have been doing this all along. And that was about 1 year before I came to Heidelberg.
Wow. Really?
Yes. So I was on fire when I came here, and I came here. You said earlier, the music industry, the Nachtschicht had nothing to do with the music industry. And I have nothing to do with the music industry. The music industry is where they make a product, like any industry, and they sell it. Mm. Used to be records, became CDs. I don't know what it is now. Downloads, I suppose. Mm. I don't do that. I just play live.
Yeah.
And it means I just play live, and it's worth it. I don't even try and record it, you know.
And, I mean, you've seen me in tears listening to you more than once. And the way that, you know, music affects me, I used to play the piano quite decently, and then I sort of lost it, and now I'm living it through you, and I'm cherishing really every moment that you're giving to people.
That's wonderful to hear, and that's why I do it. People say, what do you want people to do? Sometimes when we do a job for a fair amount, which we do a lot of that, render unto Caesar, and I like it, let's get these people dancing, and we try.
Yeah.
We don't always succeed, I'm sorry to say, but we do try or die trying. But there are other gigs and other situations where it really is just about playing the music. And I want to move people.
Mm.
I just want to move people. I don't mean physically. That's the dancing gigs. But, you know, if you ask them, ask a comedian what his job is, Boulant, my job is to make the people in front of me laugh.
Mm.
And if I go to a Boulant show, probably won't laugh very much because he's pitched his humour to the most people possible, and most of it I don't find very funny.
Yep.
That doesn't mean he's not good at what he does, because did he make them laugh? Yes, then he was successful.
Yep.
If I go and see a horror film, I have to buy the illusion that what I'm looking at is real, that the murder is real, that the detective is real, and you're there like, oh, I wonder who did this.
But this just triggers within me that you're probably one that's not made for the masses. You're just one that's, first of all, made for yourself. And if you're making that available to people, there will be an elite crowd that's totally able to follow and that's totally able to connect, which is going to give you a lot back. And the vast mass is just going to say, this is way too complex. Too complex music. I can't deal with it. I'd like the boom, boom, boom. So I'd rather stay away.
I wonder about that, you know, because when we played like big concerts like, you know, the Heidelberger Herbst or the Stadtfests around, and we play a beautiful song and Karim sings one of these beautiful songs like, you know, I feel like I was getting used to being someone you loved. Mm. And we have a saxophone solo in the middle, which of course isn't on the record. The cover bands would say, well, it doesn't go like that. There isn't a saxophone solo. I say, well, there is now.
Yep.
Let's do it like Pat Metheny would with a ting-ting-ting hi-hat. Take it all the way down and he blows his saxophone and I look out over the crowd. And we are moving them.
Yeah.
Some people are thinking, God, I love my mother.
Yep.
Some people are thinking, God, I hate my mother. Some people are thinking, I've got to take that trip. Some people are thinking, I've just such a failure. Why doesn't my girlfriend want to talk to me? But the point is, like any abstract art, like Matisse or Mondrian or something, we can't tell them what to feel. We can just put coal on the feeling fire and hope it moves them.
You can just deliver authenticity and love.
I don't think you need to be a musical cognoscenti to feel something. You can be an ordinary guy from Ludwigshafen who accidentally stumbled across the band at the Stadtfest and you think, oh, I like this. I kind of recognize the song too. It's that zombie song, isn't it? You know, zombie, zombie, but we do it completely different.
Mm.
And they don't have to go, what the fuck? I don't understand this. The instrumental stuff probably goes straight over their heads, but why haven't the singers come on yet? But when we start with the commercial music or the commercially recognizable music, you don't need a degree in musicology to like what we do.
No.
I just hope it moves them. And if you look at the vibe when you start, this sort of, well, you're a band now, do you think? And by the end, they're like,
entertain me.
Oh, wow. I am so moved. If we manage that, we've done well.
Well, you've managed it with, I think, hundreds of thousands of people, I mean, in your lifetime.
Hopefully, yeah.
And in that sense, you've lived a very, you know, sensible life, as in it was full of sense, it was full of purpose. You've made people connect to music, you've made people connect to love, and to the essential questions of life, whether it's the mother, whether it's the trip, whether it's anything, people will feel like some type of essential feeling when they listen to you. And that's, you know, I think that's the greatest gift you can give to the world.
I certainly hope so. That doesn't mean that there aren't times on a day off when I'm sitting in Mandy's in front of a, you know, omelette and a pile of French fries, and I think, what on earth have I done with my life?
I think we all have these moments. I have these moments too. You know my way. You've been, you know, a partner in my life for long enough to know that I've been through a lot of failures and through a lot of self-doubt and through a lot of shit. And I think you need to you know, to properly reinvent yourself at all times. I mean, I think the big sister of self-esteem is self-doubt. And self-doubt is part of every human life. And if that's not there, you're dead. You feel aloof, and that kills any type of life within you, I feel.
That's a very, I've never heard that. The big sister of, what is it, self-confidence?
Self-esteem.
Self-esteem.
I just made this up, basically.
No, that's great, yeah. Because I'm never happy with what we do.
Yeah,
I'm never happy with what we do.
And you're very much feared for that exact feeling. I mean, your band members, I mean, you know exactly how your band members talk about you behind your back.
Sure I do.
But you are, and that's in that sense, a real perfectionist who can be very strict on other band members if they don't do what you think is right.
Yeah.
Or but in my observation, you've gotten milder as the years went by.
Yeah.
You've changed there too, but you used to be certainly the devil in disguise on the keyboards.
Well, I've had to learn a few things, like one of my colleagues, she's going out with a thing in a minute, which I really can't get specific about because they haven't done it yet.
Okay.
And they're having their teething troubles with that thing there. And, you know, she's all like, I've got a feeling this is going to happen. And I said, look, nobody really cares. Mm-hmm. The only people who will know if it's not as good as it could have been is you and maybe the other two people in the band who feel like you do. The crowd won't care.
Yeah, it's true.
The band won't care. And afterwards, I mean, I went to see my own band once. This is a great experience. I'd had a hip replacement, mm-hmm. and I hobbled into the gig, and I sat on the mixing desk, and I watched my band being led by Lisa, actually.
Yeah.
And the bass player, Alvin, who is a very outgoing and absolutely
seen him for a long time.
Amazing player. Every time the band made a mistake, Alvin went, And I thought, you know what? Nobody knows that anything. I knew what was going wrong. I can hear it.
Yeah.
And she came off and said, oh, we're making such a mess of this tonight. And I said, nobody knows. The only time we know that you're making a mistake is when you hold up the placard saying, we fucked up. You wouldn't know for all I knew the bass could be not switched on.
No, that's true.
Nobody cares if it goes bada-bada-bada-ba-boom or if it goes bada-bada-bada-ba-boom. They don't give a damn. So long as the singers look pretty and they know the song.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's all about transmitting the energy, and it really doesn't matter what happens really on the surface. It matters what happens inside, and people will feel that no matter what.
So I've learned not to lose it when we make some kind of small error or something like that. And I've also learned by having a fixed band that I can ask the band members what they think.
Yeah,
a lot more than I used to be able to.
Do you know when I really felt that you were extremely genuine about everything that you did? I mean, I didn't need that experience to know that, but it showed me very clearly that when we took our first flight out of Hockenheim, I remember you preparing the plane and I was there, and I just couldn't believe how much very sincere effort you put into checking that everything about this plane was right. Where I'm pretty pragmatic, I would have said, oh, this is probably fine, that's probably fine too. I've just flown it yesterday, we'll be all right. But you were extremely meticulous about preparing that plane for flight. Mm. And that impressed me a lot because I thought, okay, but Jesus Christ, you know, he's a musician. Yeah, he's a great guy. And I thought he'd be a lot looser than that, but you weren't. And obviously, you know about the risk involved, but there must be something, you know, very passionate about flying that, you know, that connects you to this activity. And what is it? What is it about you and flying?
Well, it's one of the things I like about the whole flying world is that the whole of the flying world is like that. And that, you know, it's not regarded as an option to leave anything to chance, which is probably just as well. Because bear in mind, if your plane suddenly fails and plummets earthwards, there's likely to be somebody at the bottom that's going to get an interesting surprise in the middle of dinner, you know? Like, whoa, where did that come from, you know? Disregarding the people in the plane, yeah? And so what we learn as student pilots is this philosophy of, it's not perfectionism, it's just doing everything, If there's 90 things to look at, you do all 90 of them.
Yeah, the checklist.
Sod's law says that it's the one you don't that'll fail you that day.
Yeah.
There's this great video. I could recommend you watch it, anybody. It's a, just look up Cat in the Wing. It shows an instructor flying with a passenger with a joyride in a French aircraft, and it's got hollow wings. Mm-hmm. And they get about 500 feet up, and this cat appears. He's been asleep in the wing. The cat's fine, and he's like, you know. And as soon as the guy's face, when he sees the cat, it's like, what? See, he immediately pulls the throttle and starts going down.
Okay.
Well, of course, they did the outside check in the morning. You only do it once. The cat must have got in during the lunchtime, which in France is a long time. It fell asleep in the wing because it's warm. And they didn't check it a second time. And it just goes to show that...
Is that a real story? Or is that made up?
It's a video on the YouTube.
Really?
It's fucking hilarious. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You know, especially the guy's face.
What is it?
Face.
Cat on what?
It's
in, cat in the wing.
Cat in the wing of light aircraft.
Well, I'll need to check that out.
So when I'm doing the outside check and people say, what are you doing? I say, I'm looking for the cats.
Cats, okay.
Well, I'm also looking for mice because I've got these little holes in the wing and
okay.
They could get in and check in all the bolts haven't come undone and you haven't got a piece of something stuck that'll prevent the aileron from moving because there are some accidents flying. Not as many as people think because, you know, road accidents, there'll be 6 fatal accidents on the A6 today. Yeah. They won't make the newspaper.
No, probably.
But if somebody, like the guy who landed on the Army airfield 2 weeks ago,
Didn't
he had
that.
A bird strike, smashed his windscreen,
okay.
Brought the plane in to land, gaffer
tape.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Managed to land it on there.
Okay.
Flew out again, made the front page of the Rhein-Neckar Zeitung.
So I don't read the Rhein-Neckar Zeitung.
And of course, you know, my daughter sends me the clipping. And again, another accident, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the truth is that flying is quite safe compared to a lot of other things.
We know. It's what media does. You've brought a question for me.
Oh, I have actually, yeah.
And I'm curious to know what it is.
Well, am I allowed to ask the question now?
Yes, you are.
Right then.
Go on.
Yeah. Should you be on your deathbed and you know you haven't got long left? I mean, you know, hours maybe to go, maybe not even. Yeah. What would be the moments that you would most hold up as the milestone moments? What would you remember in that moment?
Gee. Yeah, that's as big a question as gets, I think. I mean, to this point, I'm still in the mind frame that if I were to die today, I will die in peace. I have zero fear of death anymore. I feel I've lived a life that was worth living. I've experienced a lot of love. I've experienced a lot of anguish, like we all do. But I've lived a very intense life, and I haven't just sort of let it slip, and I haven't just, you know, just surrendered to the mainstream or things that one does. And I've been quite good. But really, when it boils down to that type of essentiality, I'd say the moments that made me cry from love, and there was quite a few, as in whether it's a loving relationship with a woman, whether it's music, I feel that I want to live life very fully, as in I want to be emotionally touched. Mm-hmm. And everything that happens in the left side of the brain where logic lies and language lies, I'm not saying it bores me, but it's part of me, it's part of life, it's part of everybody's being. But what really kicks in is just emotionally being, you know, emotionally surrendering into nothingness. As in saying, you know, everything is so grand that me as a little, you know, incarnation that's lived for X amount of years, who am I to argue? Who am I to discuss? Who am I to criticize? Who am I to judge? It would be these moments where I felt held by the universe, which is being, you know, held in love by people that I've loved. And I don't think it'd be a moment where I was by myself. It'd always be something that I've shared with others.
Mm-hmm.
And
for me, it's more specific. There are actual moments I can remember where really
yeah, no, for me at this point in time, it's not. I mean, I'm blessed with wonderful children.
Well, for example, the moment that you met any of the children in the first 30 seconds of their life,
yeah,
was you know, it's like, oh, yeah. Hello. So you're, I mean, I got dropped off by my daughter in a car.
Oh, yeah.
Well,
she would come in. Okay.
Used to carry around in a basket, you know.
Yeah.
There are, for me, there are specific moments, really. There are, you know.
So that's one? What other one?
I mean, there's many. I mean, there was the day of first solo in the plane. That's always a good one, you know.
Yeah.
The day that I got a phone call from one of my all-time music heroes. I mean, I admired the guy this one. He said, what are you doing on Friday? And I said, you want to come and do a gig with us? And I thought, no. This is a guy that I used to listen to him on records, you know, in Cornwall. And here he is asking me to do a gig. And he became a good friend of mine. You know, I discovered that his life hadn't been as as glamorous as I thought it might have been. You know, he needed the money as much as I did. You know, it was quite funny. But these are, I think these are the moments that you sort of get as snapshots, you know, that there was this, there were some of them that I wouldn't mention whilst being interviewed, but you can imagine what I mean, yeah?
Okay.
And they weren't necessarily the moments that you did well. They were just things that made you go, wow,
well,
you know.
And that's exactly why if I were asked about a list on my dying bed, if I were asked about a list of people that influenced my life, you'd be on it.
Ooh.
You would very certainly be on it because, I mean, now for 30-odd years, you know, we've been through stuff. I mean, it doesn't matter how often we see each other, but every time I do, I feel just a huge connection to you. I have so much respect for the way that you've led your life. And you've touched me more than once. And it's not only Purple Rain, what you know, I love. And you keep, I don't always like it when you play and you're looking at me. That's cool. But it's been so many other instances where you've just profoundly touched me and many others. And, you know, that's really the gift that we're all looking for, to be very profoundly touched.
I quote you quite frequently, but I don't know how appropriate it is for this thing here.
Doesn't matter.
But I remember the time that you were on the board of directors for that famous company.
Yeah.
And the guy... Can I totally mention this?
Go on.
And I tell other people about this.
Don't worry about it.
He was a very, 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 very powerful and very notorious business guy. And he employed you, he didn't employ you, you were on the board, to find out what he could do better, what could be improved in the company. And you basically told him that if he kept his nose out of everybody else's business, the company would prosper. Probably the last conversation you had with him, but... I wish somebody would do that for a certain Donald J. Trump, you know. Just tell him the truth once.
It's going to happen sooner or later. And I mean, there's times in my life where I didn't dare to speak the truth. But now I feel and truth is a very difficult word anyway, because, I mean, we all have our own truths. But I'm not afraid to speak my heart and to speak my perception. And I did that in that instance. I paid a huge price for it, indeed. But it's led me here. We wouldn't be having this conversation if I hadn't, you know, just gone out of my way and been honest back then.
And so. You would have felt like it's a C word, isn't it? If you hadn't.
Exactly.
I spent so much of my life having conversations in my head of things I wished I'd said when I was younger.
Well.
Now, if only I'd told that guy to go shove it when I had the chance, but I didn't, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, that's basically, I think, also a request to the present to stand up for things that we feel are not right. And, you know, the internet provides a huge opportunity to speak up, but then again, it almost mutes you in the entirety of all comments that are somewhat there.
Yeah.
And I think it's in the person-to-person interaction where the magic lies, and to give each other honesty you know, your full self. Is, I think, the virtue that we need to develop, especially now with artificial intelligence coming around. The only thing that's going to separate us is being human. Because sooner or later, I mean, the artificial intelligence is going to produce unbelievable music and all of that, and we can listen to it, but we're not going to have the connection that we have when I'm looking into your eye or when I'm watching you play the piano with other people, you know, just out of the moment. That then, you know, creates magic. And I don't think AI or AI is going to be able to do that.
Ask your artificial intelligence to write a pop song and give it sort of a tune like, you know, girl left me last week and I don't know what to do. And just ask it to write a pop song. You'd be amazed what it does.
Oh, no.
Our sax player, Manuel, he just gave it a couple of words. And the song that came out sounded like everything else on the radio right now and as good.
Yeah.
And Blair, you know, Blair's basically given up doing it because he says... What are they asking us to do? They're asking us to write a song that an AI generator can do.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't sound like that, nobody's interested.
See, and that's why I feel everything is going to also diverge towards live music, because people actually want to be touched. And maybe you've just lived in the wrong time. Maybe you were just born a century too early.
Dang!
to fully reap at least the financial rewards. But I mean, and now, you know, to also find a close in this conversation, I feel you've been, you know, very richly rewarded by life by being able to feel what's essential.
Mm.
And this has been a conversation about what you feel is, or what we feel is essential. And that's that's great, because there's so much superficiality and so much crap out there that deters your mind from what is essential, that it's just extremely important to be able to feel what is.
Yeah.
And you've provided that to many people, including me, and I think that's, and I'm repeating myself, I think it's the greatest gift you can give to humanity.
Wow. It's a pity I can't get money for it, isn't it?
No. Well, you know, we all live quite decently, although, I mean, when is it ever enough?
Exactly.
You know, we've got a roof over our heads, beautiful people that surround us.
How much is enough, Elon? Yeah.
No, fuck him. I mean, not fuck him. I mean, he's just lost.
How many billions?
You can see. I mean, there's many, many, many lost people in power right now. Yeah. You can feel there's zero connection to their hearts.
Sure.
There's just, you know, everything is full of fear, and it's just something that we're going to overcome as humanity. It's going to take a couple of decades, I feel, but it'll happen, and we just have to keep tracking.
What's the proverb of the king who asked to be brought the shirt of a truly happy man, remember?
No.
And they came back and they said, we found a truly happy man, but he hasn't got a shirt.
Yeah, that'd be right.
Yeah.
This is the time to transform everything. And I think if we transform ourselves towards exactly what we were just talking about, everything will turn out for the better. Let's keep doing it.
I hope so. Well, thanks for asking me to come. And it's the most cameras I've been in front of for a long time, and probably enough for some time to come.
Yeah. It's been a privilege. You've gifted the surrounding. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. You can cut out all the political stuff and the Trump stuff and.
No. It'll be in there.
The four-letter words. And,
no, we didn't say cunt.
No,
I mean it wasn't easy.
The C word, yeah.
It wasn't easy, but we didn't say it.
I didn't want to.
Now in the outtakes, it might show, because we do record outtakes.
That's the deal I've made with myself, down on the beach in Collioure. Is I said I'm never going to play stuff that doesn't move me anymore. You know, it was a real moment of insanity in a way, because I just thought, right, it was a bit like God, if there is one, said, listen, will you stop fucking about and do this? I didn't make you to do that. You're supposed to be doing this. And I've never had any money ever since. I mean, I've lived from paycheck to paycheck, except I don't have a paycheck, but it's been great. The mistake was looking at the menu from the right to the left. Think about it.
Yeah.
Instead of from the left to the right, you know.
Yeah.
And that changed everything. It was really a moment. I mean, I didn't go to London and just immediately tear up everything I did and start doing something. But then once you've visualized something, doors start opening. It's amazing how doors also start closing. Everything in London just went and suddenly all these things started happening. And I started thinking, I wouldn't mind a bit of this. Next thing you know, I'm doing it. And I think there's this creative visualization stuff that all the Buddhists believe in or whatever. There's something in it, you know. If you start thinking,
I think it's just an aura. I mean, it's a matter of energy that you ooze, and you've always oozed that creative and not giving a fuck about much type of energy that's very attractive to people.
Well, if it looks like that, I mean, the music I love to play. You see how I look when I play.
Well, you've just
I like
gift.
Every
you've
tune
just
we play.
Got a huge gift. Yeah.
Then I go and play in somebody else's band, and I've done that as a keyboard player, replacing sick people, and sometimes I do it for the money. And I'm sitting in the van, and I've got my hands on the top keyboard and my hands on the bottom keyboard, and it's about as exciting as playing a typewriter, and it isn't happening. And I think, God, and they say, what's the matter? I go...
Which is exactly what validates the life choices you've made.
Yeah.
If you feel bad in these situations, you know exactly that you've made the right life choices.
Because I couldn't see the point of it.